Welcome back. Day two in beautiful sunny San Diego. Stay classy, San Diego. I believe that's what they said in Anchorman. Once again, Leon's next to me. Mateo's next to me. Jared's next to me. Calvin's next to me because we're at the Difficult Airway course and it's been excellent. And we've been thinking our way as much as performing our way through Difficult Airways. So let's do some rapid fire because there's lots of code scenarios, code airways that we do at this course. Jared, the trach falls out. It's day three. Nurse calls you and says, just push the trach back in. Could you?
I would not try. I would try to intubate from above.
Intubate from above. Now, the interesting thing is not everybody knows that. And it's sort of a situational awareness that we have as airway people. ENT will want to come and cover their tracks and push the tube back in right away. We can't let them do that blindly. If they're lucky and they get away with it, we still need to view that airway. But yeah, intubate from above. Mateo, anything to add?
Call for help early, right? The moment you hear about this story, you know, it can go south in many, many ways. Get your best friends at the bedside.
Absolutely. And we are pre-oxygenating. We're setting up for a plan A, B, and C. We've got our difficult airway kit handy. Next.
The patient vomits.
There you go. And in fact, they arrest. Let's keep going because that was one of the scenarios. So the patient vomits, the patient arrests. The priority at this point is chest compressions because they've arrested. So just jam an eye gel in because it can be done blindly and it doesn't interrupt chest compressions. Or you know what? They're going to need a definitive airway because they've vomited and the seal on an eye gel isn't enough to guarantee not vomiting again. Thoughts?
Well, this is the patient with a hole in their neck.
No, I think we've moved on to patient number two, but I do appreciate the clarification. This is not one patient having all the bad luck in the world. This is a new patient.
Okay, new patient. To me, I think the answer to that is nuanced. I think if you have waveform capnography with your mask ventilation and it's adequate, SAT's okay, ventilating just fine, I think you can continue that until you get ROSC and then reintubate. If you are unsure of the adequacy of your ventilation or you're unable to ventilate okay, then I would just pop in the supraglottic airway and live to fight another day until you get ROSC.
And it helps divine out the difference between a patent airway and a protected airway. Mateo, anything to add?
I think it's, as Jared said, nuanced. It's situational. What can you get at that moment, right? If you ask for the IGL, is it handy? And are you proficient in putting that in? Is that the fastest way? Sure, go for it. You have a video laryngoscope ready and a tube ready, and that's your fastest approach. Go for that.
So you put in the eye gel. Eventually, you're going to have to switch it out. When do we switch it out? 4 to 6 hours? 10 hours? 20? I know you're grinning at me because I've been asking this question through the conference because I don't think there's a absolutely right and absolutely wrong answer. And then, by the way, this will take the smile off your face. How do we do it? Can we do it with a bougie? Yes or no? Do we have to do it over a video scope? Are we just going to do it blind? I do know the answer. I'm just trying to be every man here.
What time of day is this? Is it nighttime? Are you sleeping? Are you in bed?
Listen, I know you think us guys at academic hospitals just sleep all night. I know where you're going with this one.
You want to go first?
Sure. I think the answer would be as soon as you can get the team that is appropriate to assist you with in place.
That's a good answer.
And that includes also getting the equipment that you need. And the answer is not a blind procedure.
Exactly. Which is going to be interesting because it's going to add a lot of disposable scopes to eye gels. And so the supposed upfront cost saving on the eye gel is now going to be the cost of a disposable scope. But sorry, Jared.
I would just say for me, if this is your cardiac arrest patient, as soon as you get ROSC and things have cooled down, now it's time to swap it out. If the device was put in as a primary device, I think it's fine to swap it out. If it was put in as a rescue device to rescue failure, that's the time to intubate through it. Never blindly. Because if you've put it in as a rescue device, you've probably abused the arytenoids a bit and they're probably swollen and angry and you're still going to be coming uphill over those arytenoids into the airway. And so if you try to blindly put something in there, it's probably not unlikely to go down into the esophagus and not up into the airway. And so I would use a flexible endoscope and intubate through it that way. Never a bougie.
Yeah. And I think that's brilliant nuance. And whether it's a rescue airway or whether it was the routine protocolized airway is going to be the tricky one, because if you just put it in, you never really ascertained whether it was a difficult rescue technique. You just went ahead and did it. But I think the nuance is all there. Topicalization, you gave a superb session, if I may give you a gratuitous compliment, on topicalization today. Tell us about your topicalization techniques.
Thank you, Peter. I think you contributed to that session, and that's what made it great, really, and entertaining.
We're so Canadian, aren't we?
I think airway topicalization is a skill that we must upkeep, and there are many ways of doing that, and as long as you cover the territories that are needed, you can do that. I think in a short answer, you can just say the agent you can choose is just lidocaine. There's no more role for any other local anesthetic at this moment, and a concentration of 2% at least is the way to go. Just be mindful of the total maximum dose that you can administer. Don't go into toxic levels is the recommendation. And then I can hand over to others for more nuanced.
So I don't know if this is sadist or masochist, but I'm one of them. And I've done all these different methods on myself to see which one works the best. And what I have found is...
This is a family podcast.
What I have found to work best, I take the 4% that you can get from the bronch cart, and I atomize that, posterior pharynx, soft palate, etc. Then go over the back of the tongue, airway opening. And then I use the 5% ointment. I find that if you use the 4% aqueous, it just dissolves too quickly and ends up in the stomach. And I find that 1 and 2% aren't really concentrated enough. Calvin and I have argued about the utility of nebulized lidocaine for years.
Right.
My opinion on it is that nebulized medications are meant for small particle size to go into distal airways, and that you're just wasting time. And Calvin, I'll let you give your take on that.
No, I actually agree. I think that it doesn't hurt necessarily to do it, but most of that medication gets delivered beyond the glottic opening. It's not large enough, not heavy enough to fall where you need it to fall. So I'm actually in agreement with you.
No, nice.
Yeah, I worry it's false reassurance that you numb the front of the tongue and the lungs, but the business end of what you actually need frozen isn't.
I think the important thing for topicalization is that it's the most important part of the procedure, and there's no amount of ketamine that you can give to eliminate or make up for that, and you have to be diligent about it.
Well, and the other thing is the difference between a good anesthetic and an excellent anesthetic, even if it's a local anesthetic, is time.
Right.
So you do want to drip it into the back of the airway, and we talked about drip it over the top of the tongue. My apologies. And not just sort of Al Pacino in Scarface machine gun the back of the of everything you can see. You do actually want to target it towards your glossopharyngeal. You do want to target it towards the superior laryngeal.
Yeah, you also need good coaching, because the one thing I've figured out is that it's very anxiety provoking to be topicalized, because you can't feel yourself swallow, and that's very anxiety provoking. And so you need to coach them, be soothing, play them episodes of your voice on this podcast and calm them down.
Verbal anesthesia. It's a very, very useful drug, and it's very hemodynamically stable as well. Let's keep going with topicalization for just a second. So I'd rather the awake procedure, because I think people still end up giving them a bunch of ketamine, still end up. That time to topicalize is essential. We want to rush in and just put an airway in quickly. Glycopyrrolate. We had a great discussion in our session about glycopyrrolate.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And time is of the essence here. You don't need to rush. You take your time and get a proper approach to the airway. And glycopyrrolate will help us minimize secretions. We'll give it the moment we decide we're going to manage this airway awake, because we'll see the effect, the benefit of it 10, 20 minutes from now. And that also reminds us that we should clear secretions from the oral cavity before we go in with our scope.
Yeah, because glycopyrrolate doesn't get rid of the secretions that are already there. Any evidence that it'll actually hold your heart rate up a little bit? I mean, it is an atropine-like anticholinergic that doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier.
That's indeed its main use.
Right.
So it's helpful in those regards, whether that will be what ultimately prevents you from bradycardia of significant impact. If you become hypoxic, we don't know for sure, but I'd rather have it on board than not.
Well, moving on to the next, guys. You could find to come down to the emergency department with a 65-year-old gentleman who just recently started an ACE inhibitor. I guess you can guess where this is going. He came in with angioedema, and at first the emergency department was just sort of watching him. But then he became stertorous, and his voice was starting to fail him, so they decided to intubate him, and, or at least give it a shot. So they went for an RSI, but they can't get it in. They can ventilate the patient, and so they're busy bag mask ventilating him, and they phone you.
Well, you don't really have a lot of options. So if they're able to mask ventilate them, then they're at least able to maintain an open airway. And so I would consider putting a supraglottic airway in to give myself more options. If the supraglottic airway won't go in because there's no room, or if the ventilation fails, then it becomes a crike time. We did a custom course one time where this person comes up to us and says, we see a fair lot of angioedema, and we just always crike them.
Oh, wow.
Oof.
You remember that?
I do remember that. It's memorable. I think it's very important to understand what has been attempted, to understand what's left on the table as an option. So if they've used a standard geometry blade, for example, one thing that you might get away with, depending on how much room there is between the tongue and the hard palate, is a very narrow profile hyperankylated blade that you could lubricate and slip between those two surfaces. And you might be able to spatula it around the tongue when other devices have failed. But I agree, if the patient's has been given the med, so they're on the one-way bridge, and all the devices have been tried, and the patient is now failing, you have to move to a surgical rescue.
Mm-hmm. Would this be a case for, I guess, a double video setup, if I can call it that, where you have a flexible scope plus a VL, and then try and guide it? Would that be an option for you?
Well, not after you're in the thick of it.
Yeah.
If you've planned for it, and you can keep the patient oxygenated with high flow, for example, then yeah, it's a reasonable plan.
Mm-hmm. But that supraglottic infraglottic approach is not a bad one, right? Mm-hmm. As you follow your bronchoscope once you pass the cords, and your video to get to the cords.
Yeah,
I think I would stress also the importance, as Gerald and Calvin have already highlighted, of concurrent action. So if you're thinking, I'm going to try a supraglottic airway and see if that works, at the same time, another member of the team is preparing the neck for an emergency crike. I don't need to do it in a sequential way. I'm preparing for both. I'm executing the supraglottic airway with someone already there with a scalpel, bougie, and tube.
Yeah, this is not the time for the next person to be like, well, let me give it a shot. Let me give it a shot.
Yeah. Okay, well, so that case went well. So the next one comes up. You're still down in your merge, and there's this vomiting patient who's abdunded.
Should have gone into public health.
You can hear one of the attendings yelling at the poor resident to use direct laryngoscopy because the airway is soiled. Any comments on that?
So I would say that that's often mentioned as a situation where VL will inevitably fail and DL will be the solution. And I don't think that that's necessarily the case. If you ride high in the airway, tightly opposed to the tongue, and you have good large bore bilateral suction, you can clear the airway, and then you're going to want that video laryngoscope to see what's down there. And if it gets soiled, it's easy to pull out, wipe off, and put back in. Several years ago, we published a paper in the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine that looked at rates of first attempt success in upper GI bleeders with VL versus DL, and VL was not superior, but it was not inferior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did a paper on this too with the soiled airway, and what we found was that if you contaminate the airway, you're contaminating it regardless of how you look at it. So the first attempt success of VL goes down by about 10%, but DL as well goes down by about 10%. So they don't, the gap between the two doesn't narrow. They both go down, and so you're still better off with VL. I mean, that like Calvin said, that is often mentioned, mm-hmm. and I kind of put that in the same urban myth as don't swim within an hour after you've eaten, or don't go outside with wet hair because you're going to get pneumonia. I mean, I think those are just untruths that are commonly perpetuated.
That's not true.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are you saying about my
mom? My mom's been lying to me all these years.
All right. The whole goal of this was sort of an amuse-bouche. It was not to give people the full meal. It was to talk about some tricky cases. I think the biggest benefit for the last couple of days has been spending time marinated in difficult airways and really thinking them through and bouncing ideas off people. I mention this because we're not here to gratuitously promote the conference, but it's a darn good conference and it's a darn good thing to come to. I would just encourage people in whatever way they want. Airway deserves more than 15, 20 minutes of your time, and this has been incredibly beneficial. And I hope it's clear the nuance involved in airways and that it's, yes, it's anatomic difficulty, it's physiologic difficulty, it's situational difficulty, but it's not just manual dexterity either. It's cognitive bandwidth, and it's thinking things through, and it's talking things through, and it's managing a team. That's true airway management. This is not an intubation course, it's an airway management course, and I mean that in the broadest sense possible. And with the risk of actually saying I wasn't going to give it a gratuitous promotion, and now giving it one, I'm going to turn it over to Leon.
But I've got nothing to add. Thank you, Peter. Thanks everyone for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Thanks a lot.